from a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the from a distance, we all have enough, and no one is in need. There are no guns, no bombs, no diseases, no hungry mouths to feed.
All right, From a Distance with Nancy Griffith. And I hadn't done a show since she passed, so that goes out for both her and my mom. That was my mom's favorite song. So anyway, I am Chris, and the show is Peace and Justice. We're on every Friday here at KZFR Community Radio, your community radio station, where the air quality index is 133 in the unhealthy range. So I hope people will be cautious today. We're going to be talking about climate throughout this show today, and so it's a good show because both of the guests I have with me today are very positive and people that we can learn so much from. And I want to start off with George Lakey. He has been active in direct action campaigns for over six decades. He's recently retired from Swarthmore College, where he was taught, and he was first arrested in the civil rights movement and most recently in the climate justice movement. He has facilitated over 1,500 workshops on five continents, led activist projects on local, national, and international levels. He has 10 books, many articles reflecting his social research into change on community and societal levels. His newest books are Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too, and How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning. And George, welcome to the Peace and Justice Show today.
Well, I'm glad to be especially thinking about California today.
Mm.
I don't know how you folks are managing. It must be very challenging.
It has been. It's very challenging. And many of the places that we love are burning up, and little towns we love. And it's been really rough. And you're just recovering or have recovered from a long, challenging grandparents' walk for climate justice from Scranton, Pennsylvania, Joe Biden's town, to Willington, Delaware. And I would like to hear about that. Why did you do that? And what were the effects of it? Has there been any lasting, I know that you don't do one-off actions, so I know this is part of a bigger campaign. Can you tell us about this grandparents' actions?
Yes, I'm happy to. It was, I was attracted to it, frankly, because despite having done action for six decades, I'd never done it as a grandparent. I never had carried that label with me, you know what I mean? And so this was a chance for me to be with other grandparents, and in fact, I'm a great-grandparent of five, so I'm very experienced in the grandparent business, and I really wanted to be able to stand up for grandparents, and in the climate context, especially because I look at my children, and especially my children's children, and especially my children's children's children, and I wonder, you know, what kind of world are they inheriting from me? And it just gets me redoubling my efforts to do whatever I can.
So this was 170 miles that you guys went, and at the end you were arrested in Wilmington, blocking the doors of Chase Bank. Can you tell us about Chase Bank and why they were the focus of your action?
Right. Well, Chase Bank is the number one financer of climate change, fossil fuel companies that are the main culprits, I would say, in generating all this climate change. And it's they have not been, you know, accepting responsibility for that. If you go to their website, you see a bit of greenwashing here and there, but it's obvious that they are very, very heavily invested. They're number one among all the banks in the country, and they need to reverse course and quickly. And if they don't, I think then we surely need to go to community banks and, you know, more responsible places where we can do our banking, credit unions, and we can keep after them. And one reason why I'm especially interested in bank campaigns is that I started a group that actually won a bank campaign, because we found that PNC Bank, which is the number seven bank in the country, was financing mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, which is a terrible, terrible practice. Blowing up a mountain, imagine blowing up a mountain, even that is outrageous. Talk about raping nature. And then, on top of that, extracting the coal in the process in order to fuel climate change. And so we were able to, we started in a living room, in my living room, so we're not talking about a lot of people to start with, right? We had to expand to 13 states by campaigning year after year, and by the time we got to 13 states, the leadership of PNC Bank looked at us and said, oh my gosh, these people, they are incredibly disruptive. We were constantly doing civil disobedience in bank lobbies and so on. We were making it tough for the tellers to do their work and not know what they were actually doing, you know, and the depositors were taking their money out of the bank and so on. And we were just growing and becoming more and more disruptive. We even shut down two shareholders' meetings, the annual shareholders' meetings, you know, that happened. We shut them down in the middle of them. And so they were just looking at us and saying, look, yes, it's profitable for us to be blowing up mountains, but it would be even better for us to not have this group on in our hair anymore. we were calling our group Earthquaker Action Team. We were Quakers, and we called it Earthquaker Action Team. And so we won that campaign, and nobody predicted that we would win up against the seventh largest bank in the country, but we did. So I have tremendous confidence that we can win specific victories against Chase Bank or whatever bank we want to tackle, if we learn from others how to be effective campaigners.
And it also looked like on that particular time you did a lot of self-education. You visited Waste Dump in Scranton, the Adelphia Gateway Pipeline in Bucks County, the planned liquefied natural gas pipeline threatening to cross the Delaware River. You also joined with the Earthquaker Action Team to learn about PECO, which is wanting to get their electricity from fossil fuels rather than solar or wind, and that campaign to power local green jobs. How is the work that you're doing on climate building into a campaign there on the East Coast?
Well, mostly people are doing campaigns, but not enough people are really understanding the power of campaigns. The power of a campaign has to do with the ability of the participants to really focus their attention. I run into a lot of people concerned about the environment who do a little of this and a little of that and a little something else and don't really gather their energy. But the thing is, concentrating energy is a great way of expanding the impact of energy. And we do know that in some fields, but we often forget that that's all just as true in our activism. And getting a group, which in that case I was referring to, was just a living room full of people, to really focus their attention, that became attractive to others. Whoa, instead of going to a different meeting every night or whatever, I'm going to focus my attention. And it really increased the energy available to us so that we could grow in the way that we did. So I very, very strongly recommend that. One reason why the grandparents' walk stopped at those places that you've described, thank you, is that we were also aware of our role as grandparents to be the encouraging people. You want grandparents to come to the third grade class project and tell you you're doing well. And so we wanted to do that to all the environmental justice groups along the way, to basically say, listen to their story and slap them on the back and say, you're doing well. And because there are a lot of people who don't support activist work, and we wanted to be sure that they had some grandparents on their side.
Yeah, and it was certainly not very threatening when you were in rocking chairs blocking the entrance to the Chase Bank.
First time I was ever arrested in a rocking chair.
It may not be the last. You had a very engaging conversation. I think it's important to talk about optimism right now, because when you were speaking about us being able to focus, it's really difficult because there's so many different directions that we're all going. And you had a conversation with a young man who is a dad, and he says, whenever I muster the courage to stop and think about it, I feel pretty unlucky to be alive at this time. I wake up with a sense that we might have a chance to overcome the many political, economic, and social crises we're facing, but climate change makes the stakes completely existential. It puts a time limit on what we can do about it. I live with a quiet dread, a constant sadness at the loss people around the world are already facing, a nagging fear of what's to come, and a sort of ashamed hopelessness about what we can do to stop it. And you went into dialogue with him about the optimism that you always express. Can you tell us about how we can move forward, George Lakey, because you have so much experience under your belt and so many years of organizing and going to Sweden, writing books about the Scandinavian people and how they pulled out of their roughest times. Tell us about what we can know that will help us move forward.
Well, one of the things that seemed to make a difference for that young man was realizing, which he had not realized before, that very often the biggest gains that people have made for justice and for peace and so on have been made at times that looked the bleakest, that looked the hardest. That's been true. That was true for the Scandinavians. That one reason I was so excited to get the book Viking Economics out was because they made their big push and really shifted things in the 20s and 30s. That's when they pushed their power elite aside so that they could have real democracy and then deliver the goods that now put those nations at the top of the world on all kinds of positive indicators. Most democratic country in the world, most individual freedom, shared prosperity, most equality, and so on, and so on, all kinds of rating services put them at the top. But they did their big push at a time when they were in terrible shape, when they were highly polarized, tremendous poverty. The polarization was so great that there was a growing Nazi movement in Sweden and in Norway and in Denmark. And at the same time as the Nazis were organizing, the communists were organizing for the dictatorship of the proletariat. You had a tremendous range with all the screaming and so on that goes on with polarization, as we experience it now, all this screaming going on. And anybody, I mean, if I had just gone back in time and dropped in, you know, I would have said, oh, this is not a good time for these people. This is bleak. And instead, it was the time that they were able to build the mass movements strong enough and large enough to be able to win. And then, and in fact, I was so struck by that when I did that historical research with the help of Scandinavians that I then took a fresh look at our country, and I looked at the 1930s, which was another period when things were terribly bleak. The Depression was so hard. I'm very old. I'm 83 years old. So I remember boyhood stories from my parents and my grandparents about what it was like in the depths of the Depression. It was terrible, terrible poverty. And at the same time, huge polarization. Nazis were growing like crazy in the United States. We were able, the Nazis actually filled Madison Square Garden with a rally. And at the very same period, it was the glory period of the American Communist Party. And we're talking about serious polarization, lots of violence. And the 1930s turned out to be the most progressive decade in the first half of the 20th century. And so Once I realized, oh my gosh, I may have all this wrong, I quickly fast-forwarded to the 60s, which some of your listeners probably remember, the 1960s, which verged into the 70s. And again, American Nazi Party made a re-debut, right? There's amazing growth on the left, the extreme left also. So tremendous polarization, bombings up the wazoo, way, way, way more violence, actually, than as far as we know, than in the 30s. And at that time of tremendous, tremendous conflict and need, tremendous, that was when the America woke up to its poverty. That was also the period of the greatest progressive change that we made in the second half of the 20th century. So I'm saying to this young guy, look, what you have to get a historical perspective about is that sometimes it's the night is darkest before the dawn. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things look most hopeless at the time when things are in motion that enable people and whole societies to jump forward. Now, there's no guarantee that that will happen. I'm not a historical determinist in that way, you know, saying, well, all we have to do is relax and history will take care of us. There's no guarantee, but what it says to me is there's the opportunity, and if I bring to that opportunity positive energy instead of drag myself to that opportunity with, oh, yes, we have to do this, well, then it's going to make a difference in my results, right?
Yeah, you know, and I love what you say about, you make a metaphor about the blacksmith's forge. Polarization heats up society, making it malleable. The volatility also makes positive change easier to get. And that political polarization correlates directly with economic inequality. The more inequality, the more polarization. So we're due for, you know, really big change here, looks like.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Now, it could go the other way, right? In a period of polarization that the Scandinavians were experiencing in the 20s and 30s, that was also a period of polarization for Germany. They went to Hitler, right? It was also a period of polarization, for extreme polarization for Italy. They went to Mussolini, the fascist solution.
Right.
So it is it's an extraordinary time. I'm so grateful that I didn't die years ago when I had a cancer that was supposed to kill me, because I wouldn't miss this time for anything. It's so exciting to me to see the biggest opportunity for change that I've seen in my life, and at the same time understand that it could go the other way. And it really depends on us. It depends on every one of your listeners, depends on you, and depends on me.
Right. And then you also talk about economic insecurity, which we have, and decline in the government's legitimacy were two other points that you made about this period that we're in.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I wanted to ask you more about how to get from here to there, because you are a wellspring and you've done all this organizing. You were, you know, part of the civil rights movement, and you have said that climate is a game changer. The dynamics unleashed by climate change can promote unity in a larger, broader, and more visionary mass movement powerful enough to take on the 1%. Can you elaborate on that, please, George Lakey?
Sure. Well, for example, it's for some years now, pollsters have found that there's more awareness of climate change in the black community than there is in among white people in our country. That's an attitude that's out there that exists, right? But is not reached to much at all by white environmentalist organizers. Coalition becomes possible when people have a consciousness that supports it, and also when we create campaigns that draw issues together that otherwise appear to be separate, right? So you can understand why, say, working class black people focus mainly on very, very economically framed goals and very racially framed goals. And the environmentalists are off doing other things. And the opportunity strategically for us is to frame our campaigns in such a way that it includes the economic and the racial justice concerns along with the climate concerns, the environmental concerns. And that can be done. It's a creative act. Let's get our strategy friends working on that, and our best creativity, because in local terms, that can very, very often be done. That environmental racism is a reality. You know, environmental injustice that differentially affects people of color is a reality. Finding the ways of carving the issues such that we can get wins out of campaigns that involve people of color and white people working together, that combination can win victories that's not available to either group if we stay separate. So one of the things that has over and over succeeded in America's history is when we get groups working together in coalition that ordinarily don't hang out, you know, say they upper middle class groups or, you know, professional white people, whatever, don't hang out with working class black people, let's say, but putting them in rooms together or on the street together in coalition is a very frightening thing for our opponents, because they say, oh my gosh, we depend on division in order to rule here. And they're figuring something out we don't like.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you too, my last question in this vein is about the whole effort going forward. There's millions of people who are now willing to act boldly for change. They are a lot of people that are self-identified as activists. They have a sense of urgency. But the power of these millions of people that they can generate partly depends on strategy, skill, and a learning curve of organizers. How can people educate themselves to become organizers how do we train ourselves? How do we get there?
Well, the fun of writing the How We Win book after writing the Viking Economics book was, in the Viking Economics book, it was basically showing a vision of what a high justice America would look like, an environmentally sane country would look like, and so on, because that vision can be derived from the Scandinavians because they're so far ahead of us. So that was a real pleasure to write. However, and vision really is important in animating powerful campaigns. However, once I finished that, I realized, but wait a minute, we now need a book on how do we get there. Let's say that we have a vision of what it is we want, then what are the steps? What are the campaign steps? What are the strategies we need? And so in How We Win, I have a lot of very specific, practical strategy tips that will make quite a difference. For example, one that I frankly, Chris, I almost never hear anybody talk about in among activists is the power of creating among groups working for change a power grid that connects them in a common agreement. I realized that this was part of the genius of the civil rights movement in our country in the 60s. And by the way, we are so lucky in our country to have the heritage of the civil rights movement. They figured out so much good stuff that we could use right now. And there aren't many people around anymore, you know, as old as I am, who are articulating it. So it does take some digging in history books for the most part, but there's some great movies about civil rights movement that do illuminate some of what I'm talking about. But even the movies don't show this particular thing I'm about to tell you about, the power grid. Just like the power grid in the electrical power grid that we've got in the United States, when one place especially needs more power, it can be sent via the grid from another place. And in that way, you know, everybody stays afloat. That's the way it's supposed to work anyway. Well, the same concept was being used by the civil rights movement. What they had was Albany, Georgia campaign, Tallahassee, Florida campaign, Birmingham, Alabama campaign, Selma, Alabama campaign, you know, multiple campaigns going on around local issues, right? Because that's a great way to arouse people over what it is that they can see in their own backyard is going wrong. Great. Great local campaigns. However, what Dr. King and the other architects of that movement realized was that there are going to be times when a particular town or city is reaching a place in their development of the campaign when they are in trouble unless they can get more resource. Maybe, for example, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, plus the city police are really coming down on them or whatever, and they need help. Okay, at that point, if you're part of a power grid, the energy flows from other parts of the grid to you.
Yeah, we have 1 minute left.
And that's what they would do. So people ran to Birmingham, Alabama at the right time, you know, ran to Tallahassee and so on. And that's what we could create. Now. We can create that right now.
I really appreciate your time, George Leakey. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I wanted to let our listeners know that there's going to be a feature-length film about George Leakey and his work and his life. And if you want to find out about it, go to georgeleakeyfilm.com. His last name is spelled L-A-K-E-Y, georgeleakeyfilm.com. This is going to be fantastic, and it's be so educational for all of us. And also that your new paperback is Facilitating Group Learning, Strategies for Success with Diverse Learners. And your other books, of course, are very, very important. And one of them that we talked about, How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning, is exactly what you're talking about. And we should, you know, all have copies of it. George Leakey, thank you for your time today. I really, really appreciate you.
Pleasure to talk with you, and good luck.
All right. Peace. Okay, so I've got to thank our underwriters. I'm sorry that I always have to end interviews abruptly, and I just don't like that at all. I don't know how to not do it, because that is a man who deserves so much respect for his long life of giving and teaching and sharing. And anyway, listeners, I want to thank our underwriters for making this all happen. Peace and social justice depends on you, the generous contributors, but also our underwriters. And please support Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And also Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook.
I'd like to let you know that it's noon just now. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'd like to thank some more underwriters. In this case, I'd like to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others, and also want to let people know about the Northern California Autism Symposium, which is returning on Friday, September 24th to Chico State. Presenters will share the latest interventions, services, and supports available for individuals with autism spectrum disorder and their families. Information and registration is at ncas.csuchico.edu. And I want to get on to our next interview, and I really appreciate the fact that we have these wonderful people that we're able to speak with here. Let me just get myself organized here a little, and let's go to Eliza Gilkison's new song. I heard this on the Nonviolence. Last week we talked about the Nonviolence concert that was coming up, and Eliza sang this song with others, and it's just a fantastic song. So enjoy this while I get our next guest on the line. Excuse me. Peace in Our Hearts, Eliza Gilkison. And I have on the line with me from Washington, D.C., John Cavana, and he is, or was, the director of the Institute for Policy Studies until May of this year, since 1999. He's now a senior advisor at the Institute for Policy Studies, and he directs their global economy program. I'm so excited to have him on the line. I can't even talk. He was their global economy program director from 1983 to 1997. John Cavana was the co-author of 12 books and numerous articles on a wide range of social and economic issues. His latest book, with his wife Robin Broad, is The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed, and that's what we're going to be talking about. But he's also co-authored with Richard J. Barnett, Global Dreams, Imperial Corporations, and the New World Order. He's co-led a 24-person team to create the International Forum on Globalization book, Alternatives to Economic Globalization, which has sold over 20,000 copies and translated into 12 languages.
He sits on the board of the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center, the International Forum on Globalization, the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice, the National Guest Workers Alliance, and is board chair of the Fund for Constitutional Government, as well as being a senior advisor of the Poor People's Campaign. So John Kavanaugh is a very busy man, and I appreciate him being here, but I also want to say something about his wife, who co-authored the book. Robin Broad is very important to this whole book. They did it, sounds like, very closely together. She served as an international economist in the U.S. Treasury Department, in the U.S. Congress, and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And so both of these folks did this incredible book, which I am very pleased to talk with him about today. And so welcome to the Peace and Justice program, John Kavanaugh.
Great to be with you, Chris. Really, really a pleasure.
Yeah. And, you know, before we start, I just want to, I'm going to say this just myself really quick, because I just want to get through it quickly, because there's so much to cover, and we have such a short time. El Salvador is the country we're going to be talking about today in large measure. It's about the size of Massachusetts, with six and a half million people. It had a civil war that lasted for 12 years. It saw the deaths of 75,000 people. Reagan had a lot to do with this. There was a big support for right-wing government called the Arena Party. There were death squads, and they ruled this country on the behalf of a 14-family oligarchy. The other part of the revolution was the what's briefly called the FMLN. This was a revolutionary party that tried to create some change, but you could be very easily caught in the middle if you were a farmer, a teacher, a health worker, or even a religious person. They murdered the archbishop there, Archbishop Romero, and others of the church, and it's a heavily Catholic country. Many families fled to Honduras and surrounding countries, as well as to the United States. Many traumatized kids formed gangs, and once in the United States, for their own protection, and then they gained power. Then they were deported back, and they started a new wave of violence in El Salvador in recent years. So that's my contexture of El Salvador as we start to talk about this. And then your book starts out, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Save the Country from Corporate Greed, with 2009, May. You had heard about this person, Marcelo Rivero. He was a 37-year-old teacher and a leader of a coalition of Salvadoranian groups opposed to mining, called the National Roundtable on Mining. And his group had been chosen through Institute for Policy Studies for a Human Rights Award. Can you tell us about those early days? What brought you into this?
Sure. Thanks so much. And by the way, that was a beautiful rendition of Salvadoran history of the last 40 years, Chris, which is great, and which I think many of your listeners know, because it's a country that many Americans who care about peace and justice have traveled to. But yes, on this particular story that the Water Defenders focuses on, it's interesting. I'd done work on El Salvador back during the Civil War. That's when I came to IPS. We did a wonderful book called Changing Course, which got into how Americans could get involved in fighting against U.S. involvement in that war. But I had never really spent time there. And we at the Institute for Policy Studies, we give human rights awards every October in the names of two of our colleagues who were assassinated here in Washington in 1976, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpen Moffat. And there's an incredible selection committee, which in 2009 picked this group from northern El Salvador that were fighting mining companies. And so I got involved in helping to set up their visit. They asked if they could bring five people, really well-organized group of people. They asked if we could set up a tour in the United States and Canada. And then a month into telling them about this, as we were preparing for their visit, we got this horrible news that one of the five that was to come had been assassinated, and his body found in a dry well, badly tortured. And oh my God, I mean, Americans who fight for environmental and other justice face all sorts of obstacles, as the people in northern Minnesota fighting the pipeline do right now, but seldom do people get killed. And so we were, of course, really appalled by this. We asked what we could do. They asked if his brother Miguel could come in his place, and so they came. October 2009, they came to accept the award. They told the story to this wonderful audience of 500 people, and at the end of the ceremony, Miguel came over to Robin and to me and to another of our colleagues at IPS, Manuel Perez Rocha, and said, "Hey, you know, thank you for all of this, but we need your help. One, we want your help finding out more about the companies that are coming into Northern El Salvador to mine. And two, he told us, this one of the mining companies had been denied or delayed in getting a permit to mine, and it was suing the Salvadoran government in this secretive court right near where we were doing the ceremony, based at the World Bank Group, that he said, we in El Salvador know nothing about it. How is it that a corporation can sue our government, in this case for $300 million for foregone profits, and we don't know anything about it? So we had assumed that we would just, you know, be involved in setting up meetings with them for a couple of days. And instead, here we are 12 years later, and this story became a centerpiece of our work and our lives.
Right, and you've talked about a lot of it already. I just want to go back to Marcelo and just say that he wasn't the only one killed during this campaign, and the terror that people lived under. I have to respect. I cannot imagine living with this, as they stayed strong throughout this campaign. And I just want to say their names: Ramiro Rivera, Dora Racino Sorto, and her fetus, and Juan Francisco Duran, all these other three people that were murdered during this period. And to get back to the ground here, the Lempa River supplies about half the water, supplies water to about half of El Salvador. And the Canadian gold mining company that you first learned about was called Pacific Rim Mining Corporation. And what were the original concerns of this group that was called ADES, Association for Economic and Social Development, that started in this part of El Salvador?
Well, you know, and this is similar to big corporations coming into any community in the United States. In this case, mining companies came in the early 2000s. Mineral prices were going up, so there was a lot of money to be made. And El Salvador, like several Central American countries, sits atop a big band of gold that goes through their mountains. The mining companies came in and said, hey, we can give you great jobs, and we can bring a lot of revenues into your community. We're mining companies. Agree to have us in. And Walmart says the same thing, and Amazon says the same thing with its warehouses. They ask for certain goodies to help ease them into the community. But they all come in with the same promise of jobs and prosperity. And as we got to know the people who became the water defenders, they told us honestly their initial reaction was, this sounds good. There's a lot of poverty in this part of the country. Most of the people are corn and bean farmers, and they were open to it. But as you said, Chris, in your introduction, people in northern El Salvador had a lot of experience with the neighboring country right across this Lempa River, which is Honduras. And they were smart, and they said, hey, we know there's a lot of big mines in Honduras. Let's go across the river, see our old friends, and check one out before we sign on with this new venture promising prosperity. So they did, and they went there, and the first thing they discovered, which I think a lot of your listeners may not know, although anybody who's been around mines knows it, which is the technology for the past 120 years in separating gold from the surrounding rock is you use cyanide, this highly toxic substance, which then, and you have to go through a huge amount of rock to get an ounce of gold. And an ounce of gold is worth $1,800, so it's highly lucrative if you can find it. But what they saw in Honduras were the effects of using a huge amount of water and a huge amount of cyanide on a community. And they saw dead fish. They saw people with skin diseases. And they came back realizing, okay, this company has lied to us. There's more we need to learn. But that's where their opposition began. And like good activists everywhere, they did a massive amount of education. They learned about mining, about hydrology, and they became convinced not only that their community could not survive with mining companies, but they knew the fragile nature of El Salvador's ecosystems, heavily deforested. Water is scarce. It's a very water-scarce country. And they concluded pretty quickly, a year into this fight, that they felt that all of El Salvador should stop mining.
I looking back on your book, I learned so much. I didn't even know. I mean, I knew how toxic gold mines were, but you say in the book that the Roman mines in Spain and England are still contaminated after 2,000 years. I mean, it's just, this is important, I think. And in terms of this knowledge that they had, they hired a technical hydrologist and geochemist to address it, and he did because the government, I guess, did an EIR, an environmental impact report, and then this Moran report came back talking about the impacts. And how was that first received?
Yeah, and I want to give just enormous credit to these folks who, once they discovered mining was bad, they realized they needed some help. And now this is an interesting thing. In countries all around the world, this comes out of environmental fights back in the 60s and 70s in this country, governments now require an environmental impact statement for any big project that could hurt rivers or land. Same is true in El Salvador. So the company was required to do this environmental impact statement. And then normally, you know, they have a very short period where the public can look at the report. Very few people have access. You have to go into one office and you can sit down. You can't make copies. It's really set up to be rigged for the corporation against the communities. But they knew it was coming. They knew the timeline. They knew there would be a 10-day window. So they went out and found a good expert, and they raised money internally to pay to have him come. Now, he was a straight shooter. He came in, he looked at it. We got to know him later, Bob Moran, and he did this quick, short report, which the Water Defenders, set up a forum where he actually debated someone from Pacific Rim so that people could hear all of the dangers of mining, that mining would have on their rivers and on their farms. And this helped lift up public awareness. And again, once they had that report, they spread it all over, including to the government. Now, the government at this time, it's amazing, Chris, was, this was in 2005 that the report was done. It was an ARENA government, so in a government of the party that had been linked with the death squads in the Civil War. You know, you're sitting there. It's like a Mitch McConnell government, only with death squads, if you will. Who would have thought that somebody there would be open to it? But they got it to the environmental minister there. He was a guy who cared about the law, and he read that and said, okay, this is serious. We should pause on mining licenses. And it's a reminder that you know, never, in a sense, don't presume who your enemies are going to be. This was their first instance of finding out that with good information, they might be able to win over one or two people on the other side. And due to their smarts, they actually got the government to put a pause on new mining licenses until it could study the issue more itself.
Yeah, and you know, this kind of walks along as they go. They did a They did a round table. They became La Mesa, the National Front on Metallic Minerals, which brought together local resistance linked with the surrounding countries, and they passed that national ban. And so I just see how they built this. It was just so amazing to kind of witness it through this book that you wrote, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary Peoples Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. And we're speaking with co-author John Cavanna. So the next question I think I have is mainly a statement, is that in 2009, FMLN, a TV host, won the presidency. And this was after many, many years since the Civil War. And so what difference did it make once the FMLN got in? Did that catapult things further? Or there, you had mentioned this legal suit that the gold country had had put together. What happened
well,
next?
Well, that was interesting. Yes. So here's a country, you know, horrible civil war as you describe. The next three governments were all right wing arena governments, and all of a sudden, well, the FMLN decided at that point that they needed a different kind of candidate. So you mentioned they found this guy, Mauricio Funes. He'd been a TV host. He was popular. It was a bold move on their part because he didn't have deep roots in this movement, but he was popular. He was also smart, and it's amazing. On his show a few years before the election, he'd had one of the water defenders. So he had a whole show on mining. So he knew something about mining. Now, keep in mind, mining companies operate all up and down the Western Hemisphere, and they've had pretty good luck, both with conservative governments who love them because they're big business and they bring in revenues and they get a share of the profits. But left-wing socialist governments have also welcomed mining companies in most countries. They certainly did in Bolivia, they did in Ecuador, they did in Venezuela, they did in other socialist governments. So I think the mining company thought, okay, whoever wins, we probably can convince them to speed up mining. In this case, I think the key was that this guy, Mauricio Funes, knew something about mining. So he came in and he said, look, I'm still going to pause it, we're still going to study it. And at that point, the mining company said, okay, enough of this. Let's turn to this institution that was set up about 30 years before that, where corporations can sue governments for regulations that might impede their future profits. It's a horrible tribunal, secretive tribunal in the World Bank that should be abolished and which movements around the world are fighting to abolish. But they just said, we're going to sue El Salvador because of this, and they did. And now the bad of that is everything I've just said. The good of it is it did create a window for groups internationally in the United States and Canada, where this company was headquartered, and other countries to now join the fight. Because now it's not just a fight of people in El Salvador trying to save their country and their rivers from the toxic pollution of mining. Now it's a global fight, where we're in a tribunal that has been empowered by these horrible free trade agreements that the U.S. has signed with countries all around the world. And now El Salvador not only could be forced to allow mining, they could be forced to pay $300 million in this secretive tribunal. That's where Robin and I came in. It's where the Institute for Policy Studies came in. And as we told the story to people, can you imagine there's a court where this can happen, all of a sudden, a lot of other groups joined in. And we were able to build a parallel alliance to the one you just described, Chris, in El Salvador. They created the National Roundtable with environmental groups, women's groups, youth groups, religious groups. We built a similar thing with similar groups, and actually one of the most interesting sets of groups we were able to get involved to fight against this suit and to support people in El Salvador were the big trade unions, who normally wouldn't touch a mining issue because, of course, there are big unions in the mining sector. But the fact that there hadn't been mining in El Salvador for a little bit, it got interrupted by that horrible civil war, meant that the unions in El Salvador actually were okay with the National Roundtable and okay with the call for a mining ban. And that allowed their counterparts in the U.S., the AFL-CIO, and we then turned and got the International Trade Union Confederation. Then we had real clout and a fight to say, this tribunal is outrageous, this suit is outrageous, it should be dropped. And now we've got a fight that has three flanks, if you will, on the ground in northern El Salvador in the communities, in the national legislature in El Salvador, where the groups were fighting for a mining ban, and now internationally, can we either convince the company to drop the suit, or can we put so much pressure on it that actually the tribunal rules against El Salvador? Then it's funny, you started this, Chris, by saying it's a tiny little country, 6 million people, the size of Massachusetts. Now by 2011, 2012, we had a fight that was involving people from all around the world to try to help groups in El Salvador save their country.
Yeah, and I want to recognize the 5 years of leafleting that went on at the World Bank, so thank you for that. Just the basic footwork, if not all the other organizing that you guys did. I also wanted to just mention, because it's in your book, and to me it's very important to kind of link this with other issues, is that El Salvador is a really poor country, and there was a global recession in 2009, and the United States, who knows Hillary Clinton, Zelaya, the president of Honduras, was ousted, and he had proposed an anti-mining bill in Honduras. Right. And then after that, there were over 1,000 new mining sites, many in the Lempa River watershed. So while this was, you know, while El Salvador was doing what it was doing, the mining companies certainly stayed strong. And I myself worked in Guatemala and saw some of the resistance of communities there. I think they were unsuccessful against Canadian mining companies, probably the same one. I didn't have time to look into it. But my next question is about this this mining company is called PacRim, but they have part of them is PacRim Cayman, which is a British territory, as well as they have they're in the United States through the main person who lives in Nevada, plus they're headquartered in British Columbia. So can you talk about this international thing where they go treaty shopping almost in order to make these cases against government sovereignty?
Yeah, you know, so most of the fights for justice around the world do involve big corporations that have become so big that they've gone global, and who then hire an array of lawyers to fight for the corporations. For mining companies, it's a little bit different in this sense. Mining companies know they're going to go in, they're going to find gold or silver or copper or whatever, they're going to mine for 7 or 8 years, and then they're going to leave. And what they want to do is set up a legal structure that allows them to get in and out, and then if they're sued because they've left behind a massive mess, which they invariably do, they've eliminated the company that was in there in the first place because they've shifted their jurisdictions. So it's horrible. And in one of the huge issues for people in this country right now is both the big fight to bust up some of the biggest companies that has now been enjoined on Capitol Hill, but also the fight to make corporations pay for the damage they do around the world. And so these legal entities are one piece of that fight. But here's what this company did. In addition to that, you want to be able to sue governments under the rules I just described, this secret tribunal and the World Bank. In order to do that, you have to make sure you just have jurisdiction to sue them. And in this case, El Salvador is part of something called a Central America Free Trade Agreement with the United States that was negotiated in the early 2000s, a horrible free trade agreement, but that includes the clause that empowers companies to bypass Salvadoran courts and sue them in this World Bank tribunal. But in order to do that, you've got to have a company that is in the United States. It has to be part of the countries that are part of this agreement. So that's why Pacific Rim Incorporated, when it got the sense it might want to sue, it created a subsidiary in the United States. It also had this subsidiary in the Cayman Islands basically as a tax shelter. You don't pay any corporate taxes in the Cayman Islands. Again, this is outrageous. And one thing I want to say, just to link this to the fights of the moment that we're up against, is right now, as people know, Bernie Sanders and others have this incredible bill in Congress that will be voted on in September that would raise $3.5 trillion from taxing corporations and the wealthy and use it to pay for all sorts of things, 2 years of free public college, work for mothers for universal child care, pre-K child care. There's a lot of incredible things in there, climate things in there, water infrastructure, which is vitally needed. It would replace all the lead pipes we still have. And Bernie Sanders put in that about a quarter of the money is going to come from taxing corporations that have parked their profits offshore to shield them from U.S. taxes, would tax them at a higher rate. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. And right now, as we talk, Chris, there are lobbyists all over downtown Washington trying to convince these Congress people and senators to weaken that or to take that out of the bill. So it is vital. There is a bill right now that could help stop what we're talking about here that Pacific Rim did, and it is vital for people to support that.
What's the bill?
Not allow the lobbyists to take this out of the final bill. This is this giant Build Back Better bill that the Biden administration put forward, but that Bernie Sanders is at the center of fighting for the thing. So that's a bit of the legal shenanigans. They sued, and what it's interesting what this tribunal found was that they said, okay, that was kind of sleazy, just coming in at the last minute and creating the U.S. Subsidiary. So they said you can't sue under that Central America Free Trade Agreement. However, El Salvador had a foreign investment agreement in law that allowed the company to sue under that agreement. So the case still went forward, and in that sense, this company Pacific Rim had covered all of its legal bases. It's just part of the global rules that are rigged in favor of corporations and against communities. Rules that we need to change and can change.
Right, and I don't want to run out of time, so I just wanted to tell people that what's outraged me the most about this is that this company was demanding $300 million in compensation for past expiration and for future profits foregone, and they had no right in El Salvador. They owned no land, and they could just step in there and say, oh, you owe us money for money we couldn't make, which is crazy. We need to wrap up this part, but in the end, El Salvador won this international case, and the case was dismissed. And it was amazing because you say that most countries don't win, and I agree that this whole process was so horrible. And I hope people will read this book, The Water Defenders, because we need to know what's going on. And there's so many other points in this book I wanted to get to about how important the church was, about the Pope's encyclical, the Laudato Si encyclical to protect the environment in a Catholic country, the Archbishop stepping up, Mining Watch, and the work of Carlos Padilla from the Philippines, and your wife's work in the Philippines, and how it all came together, and how eventually, after 6 years of your lives and the work and lives of others, that eventually the right wing even voted for this mining ban. So congratulations. This is amazing what you all accomplished.
No, thanks so much, and I know you want to turn on to domestic issues, so I'll simply say to people everywhere listening that imagine if this people in this tiny country, El Salvador, can organize themselves and organize us in the United States to win not one but two victories, both defeating the company in this secretive tribunal and then making El Salvador the first country in the world to ban mining to save its rivers. If they can do that there, imagine what we can do here.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know if we can do it because we don't have a history of struggle the way they do. You know, I don't know if we can, but that was one of the things I was going to ask you about. In the book, you do talk a little bit about what the key points are in a successful campaign. Can you enlarge on that for those of us who want to make a huge difference in terms of climate change and social justice and anti-militarism, and how do we win?
Yeah, great. Now, thanks for asking, Chris. And I must say, I sit here in the U.S. and I have the privilege to be involved in a number of fights here. The Apache are fighting against a big mining company to save their water in Arizona. Of course, people are fighting in northern Minnesota against this giant pipeline that would destroy their watershed. So I think often about what they and we can learn from our Salvadoran allies. I mean, it boils down for us at the end into three things. One, do your homework. So they did all their homework. They were smarter than the mining companies within a year. The mining companies were arrogant and assumed things about them that were part of their undoing. The organizers learned everything about mining, everything about water. So they were always two steps ahead of the mining company. So that kind of educate, and then doing brilliant education to get that out. They used community radio. Here we are talking about the radio. And they used public forums like the one with Moran. So do your homework and use every possible means to get the information out. So that was one. Second thing that maybe is obvious is they messaged this in a completely positive way. They did not emphasize that they were against mining. They emphasized they were pro-water. Water is life. We can live without gold, but we can't live without water. And in so doing, they created a framework that became very hard to fight against. Who isn't for water? We all need water to survive. And they did that brilliantly. They, not with any PR firm. This was their instinctual approach to this fight, and they did it well. And then finally, in a country that is as divided politically as the United States, they realized they would never win, and they would never win in a legislature where two-thirds of the elected officials were conservative. They would never win unless they won over some unlikely allies. So from the very start, getting that Moran report to the conservative environment minister, they were bold in reaching out. They found an archbishop who was conservative, but who, it turns out, had a degree in chemistry. And when he learned that cyanide was used, said, we have to oppose it. They found a leading legislator from the Arena Party who had come to the United States to college and gotten involved in environmental issues and whose great uncle had been a strong environmentalist. And they opened up to us figuring out that a secret weapon in this fight could be a governor halfway around the world who had suffered from the same mining company, and we worked together with them to bring that person there. So it suggests, and I think about this a lot in the Enbridge fight in northern Minnesota right now, who could be won over that is an unlikely ally. And I'll just say on that, it's interesting. We've been working, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who's the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, she dove in to that fight about 3 or 4 weeks ago and dug around in the Biden administration to find out who actually had the authority to put a stop, a temporary stop on building that pipeline. And through a series of phone calls, she found out that it was the Army Corps of Engineers. So then she quickly organized a letter that now attracted several dozen members of Congress and senators. And they and now the movement are zeroing in on putting pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers, pressing them to pause the construction as they do a much deeper environmental dive into what this would mean. Now, I'm not saying the Army Corps of Engineers was an unlikely ally, but people on the ground hadn't thought, okay, that's where we could go to actually stop things. So that studying who you're going to need to win over in order to win, and being open to reaching out, just picking up the phone and going out there and trying things, is a fascinating lesson for me. And I'm watching it now. You know, I do all this work with the Poor People's Campaign, and in order to win this big bill I referred to, the $3.5 trillion for everything, we've got to get Joe Manchin. And they're doing a fascinating combination of huge pressure on him. Yesterday they did a big motorcade through West Virginia to Manchin's office. They're doing all sorts of pressure, but they're also reaching out and trying to figure out ways to create positive incentives for him to vote for this full bill. It's using, in other words, use all the means at your disposal to win over the people you're going to need to win over in order to win.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much. And I wanted to ask you also another thing that's really important. I think you might be able to ask is that mining isn't going to end. We're going to need some of these rare earth elements like lithium for batteries. And right now, I think that's part of why the U.S. and China are at loggerheads. But it also affects indigenous people whose countries the lithium is under, as well as water supplies. And is there ever a way to do things in a socially responsible way? I went on the web and looked up green mining and greenwashing and corporate responsibility. And how do we take guidance about how to go forward with what is going to be needed in the future?
You know, I think so. It's a great question. And I think that it's mining in the sense for every reason you just said is very different from fossil fuels, from oil and gas. Oil and gas, we now know we can live without. We can phase them out, and we can create a clean energy future through alternatives and through energy efficiency. And it's a fantastic conclusion. However, I just ask you, look around your room. Half of the things you're looking at have metals in them. So we can't live without metals, and as you pointed out, Chris, the shift towards clean energy is going to increase the use of lithium, just to take that one, because it's critical to the batteries of electric cars and so on. So what do we do? And what we've concluded, the shocker to us in writing this book is no, there's no such thing as responsible mining on a large scale. Mm. The chemicals you use and the amount of water you use is inherently dangerous. What that means is we've got to stop about half of the mining in the world. And we can do it. So the key here is right now in the United States, we only recycle about 30% of the metals we use in our phones, in our computers, in our cars, in our refrigerators. We could get that up to 90%, and we could create millions of good, decent jobs in the process, and we could eliminate half of the mines in the world. Now, lithium, on the other hand, there is going to be an increase in its use in this massive transition, and there we've got to be very careful. In other words, our message isn't, okay, let's shift from having two gas-guzzling cars in each family to two electric cars. We've got to reduce the use of cars. And it's interesting, in this big Bernie bill, there is a lot of money for public transit. We need to revitalize public transit in this country the way it has been done in Europe. It would have a great racial equity component to it as well. But we need to reduce consumption of cars, period, because there is no safe way to mine lithium and other products. In the end, there are places where there should be no mining, like El Salvador, because it's water scarce. shouldn't be mining in indigenous areas. There shouldn't be where there's earthquakes and typhoons. And so the remaining mines need to be in places that don't have those restrictions. And you can do it a little bit safer, but largely this is going to require a big shift in both our consumption habits and in our recycling habits. Right now, everybody listening to this is recycling paper and plastic, I'm guessing. In 5 years, we all need to be recycling the metals that we use and buy.
Important. So my last question, it has to be really a brief answer, and it's unfortunate because I wanted you to talk about the Institute for Policy Studies and how we can learn about it and how we can support it. And lastly, I want to tell our listeners, too, that this book that we've been talking about, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed, is fantastic. It's available from Beacon Press, Boston. And so read this. Okay, go ahead. Tell us about Institute for Policy Studies.
And I know we just have a few seconds.
Yeah.
So, yes, I work at the Institute for Policy Studies. It has a project on trade and mining. So just Google Institute for Policy Studies, and you can read about, learn about the work and how to get involved in it, as well as our various allies like Mining Watch Canada that Chris Hsu so lovingly mentioned. So join us in these fights. And also join the local fights in your community against big corporations that are coming into your community.
John Cavanaugh, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate both you and Robin Broad, your wife, in all of your work for social justice and for the earth and the environment and the people of the earth. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and the same to you, Chris. You're doing an amazing job there.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we're winding down on the Peace and Justice program. We'll be back with you next Friday. But later today, it's very important to tune in to the shows that will help you to relax and unwind from your long week, starting with Playing Dead. Ray Lager will be in the house at 1 o'clock, followed by Devastation Sounds. I had a couple of notes for myself that I wanted to read you. There was an important water meeting this week, and it was covered rather brilliantly by Sue Hildebrand's show, The Real Issue, which was Wednesday night at 6. If you go to the KZFR.org website, go to Wednesday under the Programs tab, and 6 o'clock, you can listen to the archive of that. And if you want to learn more about the issues being covered, which are threats to our groundwater, go to buttewaterwatch.org and also aqualliance, one A in the middle.org. And also wanted to let you know that the over 103 acres is in planning here in Chico Town. Will have a profound effect on our communities, especially in South Chico. And so if you want to learn more about the Barber Yard Project, go to engagetheteam.com/Barber Yard. And let's see, I also wanted to announce, which I think is important, that there is 113 new COVID cases as of yesterday, Thursday. Only 41.85% of our Butte County is fully vaccinated. There are 81 people hospitalized, 6 in the ICU, all unvaccinated. They have Enloe Hospital posted they have 51 COVID patients, 43 are not vaccinated, and all 5 in the ICU are all not vaccinated, 3 of whom are on ventilators, which does not bode well. And I want to get somebody else on the phone, so I'm just going to put on a little George Winston for you, and hang with me here.
you're here at the Peace and Justice program. We're in our last few minutes. I wanted to take this time. I don't want to have a show go by where we don't talk about the crisis in our community with the unhoused. And I have on the line with me Nancy Wirz. She is a tireless advocate for the unhoused, especially at Comanche Creek, but she goes everywhere with so much water. She brings water to people with no water. She talked about water protectors. Nancy, you wrote a letter to the editor. Would you like to read it?
Sure. I wrote it 2 days ago saying, I just read where Mayor Coolidge says the city is paying $35,000 per month to rent the abysmal asphalt-covered space right next to the airport runway for the homeless to use as a resting place. I know that there are at least 10 people who have parked vehicles there, probably more actually, but with armed guards, that should be a safe parking lot. I wonder how much the guards are costing in addition to the rent and the gravel that was spread over the asphalt to make it look more homey. It appears to me that the city has set this plan in motion, as they told us, to placate the judge, who has told them they are behaving illegally while not actually improving conditions for our citizens who are actually homeless. The faster they spend our money, the sooner they will be able to say they have no more. I am beyond irate. That money could be used for actual help. Tiny houses on unused city land, campground monitors where people actually are and can lay their heads down without dying of heat prostration, bonuses to developers willing to consider building lower-income housing. I think the city is deliberately wasting very large amounts of taxpayer money in hopes of being let off the hook for turning our community into a dead end for people who have little money. Could Chico really become Palm Beach North with any amount of their chicanery? I think not. They are deluded as well as dishonest.
Thank you for that, and I look forward to reading that in the Enterprise Record also. Nancy Wirz, the work that you've done, I think you've done just out of your own sense of moral responsibility. I don't know you that well, but I know that you're out there all the time. And what do people who are unhoused need, and how can people provide it for them?
Okay, well, I am under the Safe Space umbrella now. I did a lot of this on my own, but I'm on the Safe Space board. And Safe Space really worries about the least of the least, the people who are struggling the worst. And donations to Safe Space are wonderful. Also, taking water, taking ice to people on really hot days. We have taken hundreds of pounds of ice just to give to people so that they can cool the backs of their necks when it's 107 degrees out on the ground. They Tykert Ponds always needs water. They say that Safe Space is the only dependable source of water they have, and we've started now going twice a week because we take 80 gallons on Sundays and we're taking 50 on Wednesdays because it's the only water they have for washing and drinking. They can't drink out of the ponds.
And I wanted to just tell our listeners that there is no place for them to get hygiene, to go to the bathroom.
No.
There's no garbage dumpsters.
No, there's nothing, no garbage disposal. Nothing. There are no porta-potties at Tykert. I find the people, I know there are, you know, people who are less grounded among them. But I find I've made a lot of friends among the homeless because they are really our neighbors, and they're just like my other neighbors. They just have less money. They also really appreciate baby wipes. Those are like gold. Mm. And buy them at the dollar store if you don't have a lot of money because they're cheaper there.
Nancy, we're going to have to leave this here, but I really appreciate what you're doing. And how many people are at Tykert Ponds, just so people have an idea of just this one homeless encampment?
Well, I heard yesterday that there are 60. The last time I counted, there were 40.
Okay.
So roughly 50 unhoused people. Yeah.
There are a lot of people without homes, and they do move around because they get frightened by the bad guys. And they look for a safer spot, and when it turns out not to be safe, they'll move again. It's not safe to be homeless.
No. And it is important for our city council to step up, and it's important for all of us to raise our voices, correct?
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah.
We need to stand up and say, all citizens deserve to be safe, not just the ones in houses.
Thank you, Nancy Wurz. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you for asking me.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So the opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinion of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters, just mine and my guests. I'd like to thank our underwriters once again. We really, really appreciate the support for keeping the station strong. We want to thank the Butte County Fair, which is creating memories for over 80 years. The tree-lined streets of the fairground welcome visitors from across the region starting on Thursday, August 26th through the 29th with family-friendly nightly entertainment, a carnival, fair food, and more. Details and ticket specials are at buttecountyfair.org and by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue, and for details, go to squaredealmattress.com. So stay tuned for Playing Dead. I am going to get out of here a little bit early, looks like, not too much, but we're going to go to the community calendar, and then Ray will be having a great show for you, so enjoy that. Peace to y'all.
Hey listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The North Valley Property